This is November 6, 1999. This is the second interview with Galen Martin. We are doing the interview in his office in Louisville, Kentucky, and the interviewer is Betsy Brinson. You'll notice that there is background noise, which we are not able to eliminate.
All right. I think, part of my problem is if I do things one day and I come back the next day, I can't remember that well what we talked about. That's not that surprising.
Well, that's okay. I've actually listened to the tapes that we did last week.
You can remind me. Gail, we've already covered that.
Right. I have some better sense, but I don't always remember either. But.
All right. I just don't want there to be any doubt that by far, the most important thing in the life of the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights, school desegregation. And, you know, other people may think other things, and that's fine. I respect other people's points of view. But there's no question in my mind that that was the most important thing that the commission ever did and that I've ever done. Okay. And clearly we were a part of that lawsuit. And I know I told you some of this.
And this was the lawsuit filed
in 72. Yeah. Now, of course, I was here when the schools began desegregation in 56. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's all portrayed in Omer Carmichael's book that told how they began. You know, they made good beginnings, but they rested on their laurels. They didn't refine and revise and update. And, of course, Carmichael, you remember, got invited by Eisenhower to come to the White House to tell Ike how he had done it. So it was
well,
it was big
now,
time.
I have to back up. Tell me who Omar is.
Was the he was the school superintendent for the Louisville schools. And see, they provided very clear leadership to achieve desegregation. Unlike George Wallace and so on, they sent home. They took the initiative. Now, this was in the fall of 56, and they devised a totally voluntary plan. You know, there were 13 or so other lawsuits brought around the state, but we didn't have a suit at that time. So they devised a plan, and they sent home cards, 8x5 or something, you know, that size, whatever it is. And on those cards, they stamped in big, bold letters about that big the school where they thought the child ought to go. Black and white children, and nearly everybody accepted it. So that was a big deal, and that was so early in the country's history with Brown that it mattered a lot. But anyway, the big thing that of course the commission wasn't created then. But
well, let me ask you about that. If everybody accepted it, did that involve transportation issues to move people around?
No, the city of Louisville had no buses to speak of. They had some, but very few buses. So people were, as I recall, some of them were going on city buses, regular city buses. But it did not involve, you know, it didn't involve any busing.
Okay. And you thought it was a good plan?
Yes, so far as it went. It did not include teachers, which was a gross failure that Lyman Johnson, of course, challenged the superintendent on, and properly so. And then they just quit. They quit. And they rested on their laurels, and it got worse in the 60s. And by 67, we were pointing it out. And we at the State Commission and a reporter was pointing it out. And then in the fall of 72, well, no, not the fall. In roughly, well, I'll tell you exactly when it was. Because, you know, despite what one might think, we decided that we were going to file that suit, and we waited till the legislature adjourned. And wisely so. We knew what the heck we were doing. This stuff was just not stumbling around. And the Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP were both split in that they didn't really want to support merger of these districts. And so Tom Hogan and I put together a suit for merger and desegregation. Now, none of this I've told you, have I? Is that
no.
correct? Okay,
no.
All right. I told Larry Knowles' class, again, I meet with him nearly every year, but anyway, I told them, so that's getting me confused. But anyway, both the NAACP and the Civil Liberties Union were split over these issues at the outset, And they both had votes that ran like 12 to 2 in favor of keeping the districts separate. Mm-hmm. Hogan was one of the dissenters, and Lyman Johnson was one of the dissenters. So we got together a lawsuit that Hogan, of course, drafted the papers and had me sign. And Hogan said to me, he said, well, let's go ahead and put you down there as on behalf of the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights. And then you can pay all the Xeroxing costs. Sadler wrote the stuff. And once we got into the, and see, we, whenever
Bob
we marched,
Sadler.
Yeah, whenever we marched to the courthouse, why the Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP and the Legal Aid Group and so on, they laid their papers down first. So they were the prime movers in the suit.
And Bob Sadler was representing the Civil Liberties Union.
Yes, yes. And then right, you know, we marched in with them. Right behind them, we laid our papers down on the clerk's desk. Mm-hmm. But from that time on, we were all together. We were totally together. Mm-hmm. And we also, Hogan and I also tried to bring in Anchorage, which they finally threw out. Mm-hmm.
Now, for the readers, Anchorage is actually a little, community
separate
within
enclave.
Louisville.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Wealthier folk, and they got thrown out for whatever reasons.
Did the NAACP have an attorney?
Yes, they definitely did. Daryl Owens is a lone survivor among those folks. It's me and Daryl, I think, is the only, nearly only ones that are still around. But also Lunderman, Mr. Lunderman.
Lunderman?
Yeah, L-U-N-D-E-R-M-A-N. He was also on that suit with Daryl.
Okay.
Daryl is totally committed to all these things still and with us. But anyway, and frankly, you know, it was not like the commission members ever, if the truth be told, it was not like they ever exactly voted on that suit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's nearly everybody would, if they looked at the record, they would say that the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights was in it. But it's not like they were a plaintiff. Mm-hmm. We just put that on there on behalf of them, and we got away with it.
Mm-hmm. So how much Xeroxing cost did you end up with?
How much of the Xerox? I don't know. We sure never kept any records.
Right.
You know, these days they've got these counters on the Xerox machines. Oh, it was thousands.
Yeah.
I don't know. It wasn't. It didn't really matter. I mean, nobody could ever track that on a bet.
Right.
And I think I did recite to that stuff to you where Oberst's name got dropped in when we went before the Senate. Well, that's what they were talking about. See, mm-hmm. They were challenging. The three of us, they were challenging Sadler and Hogan and me, all of whom were really on a state payroll or another. So that sort of...
Well, know. Now, wait a minute. No, you didn't tell me that.
Remember, I think I did. Maybe I didn't. I said that we were before the Senate committee, and these people were trying to pay... See, there was a big backlash, so to speak, in terms of opposition to school desegregation. And, you know, Todd Hollenbach was the county judge then, and he called a national conference on alternatives to busing. He was corrupt, totally bankrupt. But anyway, so, and there was all this stuff, all this backwash against school desegregation. Mm-hmm. And Julian Carroll got caught up in that. Mm-hmm. And so they called him to testify before the Senate. Okay. Mm-hmm. So at that hearing, while they asked him, you know, the Republicans, it was a put-up deal. I forget who it was that asked, but it may have been, you know, someone like Orrin Hatch or one of the guys from Carolina. I know who that was, but my memory's thin at the moment. Mm-hmm. And they asked Carroll, well, Governor, if you say you're opposed to busing, which he did, mm-hmm. See, at the very time that we're trying to get the school thing started, Julian comes up there and testifies against busing. Mm-hmm. And the other senator from the opposition said, well, Governor, if you say you're against busing, how come you got these fellers on the state payroll named Sadler, Hogan, and Martin? And that's when he did this gymnastics of trying to claim that we were on other payrolls and he wasn't liable for it.
Well, let me stop a minute. I know where you were, and Bob Sadler was at the law school.
Yes.
University of Louisville.
Yeah, and Tom Hogan was a top aide to Norbert Blum, the Speaker of the House.
Okay. Thank you.
So there was sort of an out, you know, none of us were really regular state employees. I was the closest, but Sedler was, you know, it's a law school prof can do anything they can get away with. Mm-hmm. And similarly, the speaker's aide. But it's just a dicey little thing. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't know that vignette has anything to do with anything, but the point I'm trying to make is that this was extremely important. Mm-hmm. And for instance, Gary Orfield, that you can call as an authority on this, it's his view that we were frequently described as the best state human rights agency in the country.
And tell me who Gary is.
Gary Orfield is this guy right here.
Oh, the author of a book, Dismantling Desegregation.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's the world's foremost expert on school desegregation.
Okay.
He's a honey of a guy. He's from Minnesota originally. His brother's in the legislature up there. When he first started, he was at the University of Chicago, but he's moved on to Harvard. He's been there many, many years by now. But if you're interested in that or that subject matter, well, Gary, and what he said was, we had an anniversary dinner here, like, honoring Judge Gordon. Mm-hmm. The judge wasn't able to come. But Gary at that meeting said that no other state commission on human rights ever got within 10 miles of a school desegregation order. Mm-hmm. And alas, that's pretty much true. Now, Pennsylvania has been into it a little, mm-hmm. to some extent. Mm-hmm. And I'm not necessarily repeating Gary's thing for the truth of it as compared with Pennsylvania.
Right.
I'm just saying that that's what Gary said, and
right.
he did.
Right.
And you know, not only that, we put out these periodic reports on teachers. We put out a lot of periodic reports on school desegregation around the state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's, I just think by far, and of course I was a full participant in all the pretrial conferences. Mm-hmm. Never the brains, mm-hmm. but I was there and I learned from it, and it's my most important education.
Tell me about the plaintiffs.
Well, of course we picked Lyman.
Mm-hmm.
Well, very well known, and Lyman was delighted to be involved, and then we had six or eight other citizen-type plaintiffs, mm-hmm. Many of which were teachers, black and white teachers, some of them at Central High School, and then other citizens plaintiffs, of parents of, or grandparents of children in the school system. So those were our plaintiffs.
Was Susie Post one of those plaintiffs?
She was more involved on behalf of the Civil Liberties Union. I think generally she is considered a plaintiff.
Okay.
And her name is in the documents. You know, I can't imagine that you want this, but you know, we've got the docket sheet because it's pertinent to our current litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And Susie's name is listed in that docket sheet. And as was John, you know, the legal aid people and so on, the various attorneys. The docket sheet just tells you who the lawyers were and what the actions filed were, but it's...
So how long did the case last?
From 72 to 75, and that's when the order was issued, in July of 75.
And the order was to do what?
To desegregate all the schools.
Okay.
And of course, see, it's I don't care what anybody says, it's the best desegregation order in the country. And Gordon, if I haven't given you a copy of the leaflet, I know where I can go get one real quick. I think it's all characterized by this little leaflet that said six ways to avoid busing.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, my daughter was sitting on the couch one evening, we were watching TV, and she picked that up and read it. She was then going, getting ready to go in the ninth grade at Central, which she stayed for 4 years. But anyway, she picked that up and she said, "But Daddy, it all seems to me like it's one way, just desegregate housing." And that's what it was, you know, it approached it from several points of view of what people could do to promote desegregation. And that was the genius of Gordon's plan. And of course, we at the Fair Housing Council are mightily involved in this effort to maintain that plan.
So the
crux of our effort was stated by one of the lawyers we met last Friday on our side, Cheryl Snyder. I don't know if you know him at all, but anyway, he's involved in it. He said this, but everybody else agrees with it. What we're trying to do is to show that this district is different from every other city in the country, most of which have had their plans destroyed. They've been trash. You know, Charlotte is the most recent one, and Boston, and San Francisco, you name it. They're just, it's a shambles.
So you need to provide some history here. So you got an order in 75.
Yes.
And then the order began to be implemented.
In the fall of 75.
Right. And then what happened? It sounds like you're back in court again now.
Well, we are back in court now because a small group of black students and parents have sued to resegregate Central High School. Now, those latter words are my words. What the essence of their suit when it started out was to increase the numbers of black students at Central above, so that they would go above 50%. You know, the plan has got amended. Many of the amendments were called for, others were never proper, never should have been done. But the plan has been amended, and so now the ratio that's required, and that ratio has had to be increased because the percentage of black students in the system has grown. Okay. So now the ratio required is a 15 to 50% black in every school. Essentially what they want, the other group wants, is to let Central go above 50%.
And these are black parents that are bringing that lawsuit.
Yes.
What's behind their motive to do this?
Well, it's mixed. Some of them are separatists. Some of them represent a group in town that really would move Central and make it into a black elitist academy. They would try to attract the best black students and the sons of political officials and so on, and make it super education for blacks, and that's our view of it. Now, nobody's ever said that on paper, but from what we know of some of these people, and we've been in lots of meetings with them, we think that's an element. Others are caught up in rhetoric. I heard this again last night or Saturday night. They say, well, if a school can be desegregated when it's 75% white, why can't it be desegregated when it's 75% black? Well, that's nuts. It's reasoning in a box. The point is that this district is 30% black. And so for Louisville, our schools should all be in a range of plus or minus 15% or so over that 30%. And the ideal thing would be to have all of the schools at the midpoint. And that's what Pat Todd, a very good person who's in charge of trying to keep these schools even, that's what she is trying to provide leadership to do, to keep them as near the midpoint as can be done. And if we start letting Central High go to 55 or 60%, then we're convinced it will go to 100%. That's immediately what Gary Orfield said. I called him, and he's been to Louisville a lot of times, and he's the chief expert witness that the school board has called. If they hadn't called him, we would have called him. It's good that they can do it because they can pay for it.
So the school board is actually opposed to the law?
Oh, absolutely. And see, what is crucial is that that we get a decision which says that this district is not unitary, meaning that it's not achieved enough desegregation so it can be declared unitary, because if it's declared unitary, then we lose all protections of the federal court. And we need those protections. We need those protections to achieve teacher desegregation. They're way off where they ought to be. They just have a tremendous gap between the percentage of black students and the percentage of black teachers. So we want the court protections. That's just one of dozens of reasons why we need them in it.
Of course, we're very short nationwide on black teachers.
Yes.
And that must become an issue in all of this too.
Well, there are those who claim we can't find them, but we're unwilling to accept that. And the point is that they've got to try harder, and we don't think they're trying hard enough. So it's an argument. Okay. It's like lawyers.
It's like the recent news that there's not a single black school superintendent in Kentucky.
Yes. Well, that's old news, but it's new. I mean, it's recent. It's ongoing.
Right.
It's been that way a long, long, long time. They have increased the number of principals a little bit, black principals, but the black teacher level has gone from 7% roughly, which it was under segregation, we're down to about 4+%. Mm-hmm. So it's way down. But anyway, that's what I think that, in my opinion, is the most important thing that we did ever, the State Commission on Human Rights.
After the Judge Gordon issued the order in 75, did the commission put in place a monitoring process at all?
We were never for much for participating in my time, you know, in monitoring with other groups. We fundamentally believed that it was the responsibility of the lawyers and the school system to do the monitoring. Now, the school system has had its own monitoring committee, including some segregationists on it. But what the commission tried to do was to put out periodic reports on the status of segregation and desegregation. And, you know, on page 2 here is a new elementary and middle school assignment plans creating dual school system, 85 to 86. Let's see what else we had. But anyway, this doesn't reflect all the publications. This was just whatever year this was done in. This tended to reflect the ones that was most current.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask you about that because it's actually a very nice list I looked to on multiple topics. But it seemed to me, looking at the list, that most of your published reports didn't come until the early 70s.
No. Like I say, this is just.
So there were.
In other words, if we put this out
in.
If this list was put out in 87, we didn't necessarily list all the things that we were doing in 60. We just tried to list the most recent ones. Here's a clue. Here we say black staff employment up at state universities, except for executives, 75 to 85. Okay, so we put out those reports. And then there's a parenthesis, and that one was dated April 87. And then there's a parenthesis, previous reports on university non-faculty staff employment since 1977, available upon request. In other words, so we were reporting for many of these things we did for 15 years. The reports and some of them longer, I'm sure, but the reports on, here's another report, August 84, black teachers lose employment ground. Well, again, that was a report on 30 years since the Brown decision. Okay, so the reports we were into were something that most of those were done annually, or maybe every 2 years in certain occasions. And we did the reports on public housing desegregation. We did those at least 15 years. We did the ones on teachers, public school teachers, university faculty, public school desegregation, more in Louisville than in other states, I mean, than in other cities. Some in Lexington, but less for Lexington than for Louisville. But here's one, segregation persists in Fayette County schools, 85 to 86. Again, this previous report is thrown in there.
Then in 1971, you published Kentucky's Black Heritage for use in Kentucky history courses.
Yes.
A good document, which I use fairly regularly now, and I've seen it among other places I've been. What went into deciding to do that project?
All right, now I'm going to repeat something that I can't remember whether I told you before or not. Our staff looked at these histories that were coming primarily out of, for Kentucky history, you know, the required mm-hmm. course in Kentucky history. Mm-hmm. And we had these texts that came particularly out of Texas. Mm-hmm. And the wag was, among our staff members, that they undertook to show that slavery was a pleasant experience in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. which we found, mm-hmm. we didn't believe it. Mm-hmm. But that we were trying to get this adopted as something of a text for the Kentucky history course. Mm-hmm. What they ended up doing was buying it for the black students. And, you know, we didn't print that many. I don't know what the printing, we did two or three or so printings.
They being we may the have ended school up, system?
Or? Yeah, the school systems. We wanted this to be in the hands of every child right. who studied black history, because right. we wanted the whites to know that blacks had a history.
Right.
They robbed us of that. That we never, it never, mm-hmm. never came down the way we intended it.
Mm-hmm.
They just wouldn't, we could never get this thing formally adopted. Some of the districts would buy, you know, enough for all their black students, but hardly any of them ever did much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that they treated it like black history was for black students and white history was for white mm-hmm. students, and we're not going to.
That's unfortunate.
So, and you know, it's not perfect, but I don't know anybody who's had anything comparable to it, hardly in the country. You know, there's just
right.
nobody else who's done
right.
much like this. And
well, then, at what point did you also begin to develop the poster series on great blacks in history?
I can't remember the date, but I remember exactly the place.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Columbia, South Carolina, and visiting a guy who's since gone on to bigger and better things, I think with the, what is one of these big foundations there? They advertise on public radio all the time. McDonald, what the heck, McSomething Foundation. Anyway, that's irrelevant. He had one of these posters in his office about, from the gallery of great blacks for the country.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the one about the guy in South Carolina. So I came back and we started on that thing immediately.
Do you remember, would that have been during the 60s or was it later in the 70s?
Probably 70s. I can't remember
okay.
offhand, you
okay.
know, and it's just.
And again, you distributed them to school systems?
Yeah, yeah.
So for posting in classrooms,
yep.
that was the...
Yep.
Okay. At what point, Galen, did you begin to address desegregation in higher education?
From the get-go, as best as I recall. I don't think we ever held back. We might have gotten we probably got a slower start. And I'm not that sure that we ever did much by way of reporting. I don't know offhand. I just don't remember reports on student enrollment in higher education. Those I think we were getting fairly decently from other sources, and clearly from the get-go we got the faculty reports.
Mm-hmm.
We did some of those,
mm-hmm.
As I recall, and I think some of them are cited here.
Well, and I've seen references to data that you were collecting in higher ed in some of the very early annual reports of the 60s that
yeah.
you prepared. But then
yeah.
I also came across some correspondence in 1974 where you wrote the Kentucky Council on Higher Ed
yeah.
asking them to develop a statewide desegregation plan.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I see here now, August 86, well, apparently we put out reports on black university faculty employment since 77.
Do you think this 1974 request, though, was the first formal request you made to the State Council on Higher Ed?
I don't know. What I think was happening was that regular schools, high schools and so on, that desegregation was moving along. And the focus got turned with the national suits to dismantle the system of dual higher education, the ones that the Legal Defense Front brought, that my buddy Joe Rao You know, Joe I knew at ADA. He was, again, I know there's very few people that I tell you are a prince of a guy. Joe was another prince.
Mm-hmm.
Like Bob, did you know Joe at all?
I have a former colleague, Daniel Pollitt, who taught constitutional law at Chapel Hill.
Yeah,
and he worked with Joe.
Yeah,
on a number of
Joe was a beautiful, beautiful man. And of course, I still remember seeing him over the years since I was at SDA. But I know this is a total digression. But the beautiful thing about Joe was he was the most tolerant of the ADAers toward the students. Some of the others, they wanted the squelches, but not, no, Joe was not, that wasn't his style.
Right, well, that would fit what I've heard about.
To this
Paul Oberst.
Okay, at this I think it was the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights or some other group like that in Breathitt's time, whatever, and also Lyndon Johnson's time. Mm-hmm. And the cotton picking meeting was held in this terribly ornate Indian treaty room. That would be enough to force Indians, seeing the, in all these statues and so on, be
in
enough to
Washington,
force you to sign a treaty. Yeah, it was in, you know, the Treasury offices, the executive offices there, the old Treasury building, kind of just west of the White House. Mm-hmm. But anyway, among others who were there was the president of Berea College, Hutchins. And Hutchins got me up for a walk in the streets of Washington. And bless Patty, here comes Joe Rowell along. So here's little old Galen Martin introducing the president of Berea College to Joe Rowell. So on the streets of Washington. So.
Well, Hutchins, but, tell me, do you remember his first name?
Francis.
Francis.
Was this one. He succeeded his father.
H-U-T-C-H-I-N-S?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And he was there. Oh, Paul and I represented Breathitt somehow or other. I forget what who he was representing, but anyway, he was in on that same same thing.
I interviewed Elizabeth Oberst on
Saturday,
and I thought at one point she excused herself to go and ask him if he felt up to talking to me.
Uh-huh.
He said no, so I didn't get a chance to talk with
him.
He's
a good man.
Yeah.
Good man.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about housing discrimination, because that, of course, has been illegal in Kentucky since 1968.
All right. That's right.
Can you describe for me the commission program to deal with housing discrimination?
Absolutely. I remember it like it was yesterday. We, of course, got, since we wouldn't agree in 64 to the compromise for public accommodation, we got very solid, beautiful coverage for employment and public accommodations in 66. Good descriptive language that covered infinitely more than the federal law did in both employment and public accommodations. We went back to the original public accommodations language that I mentioned to you before from the American Jewish Congress, and we got it. And Breathitt got it passed. He got it passed, incidentally, as the second bill, only after the budget. He's got his budget passed, and that's what he told us he was going to do. And of course, John Y. Brown Sr. was the one. He gave this great speech about Garibaldi and so on, and among other things. I don't think this is really a total digression, but in the most recent biography about Pritchard, mm-hmm. you know, Ed Pritchard, it attributes to Ed Pritchard the writing of a speech in support of the Civil Rights Act, a speech that was given by a black member of the House named Jesse Waters. And bless Patty, that book claims that Pritchard wrote that speech. Pritchard didn't write that speech. I know the guy who wrote it. He was a staff member of ours, a guy named Archie. Oh, shoot. I can't think of Archie's name. Anyway, Archie wrote the speech, and I've never gotten around to telling the author that, and I've not been able to track down Archie. But one of these days, I'm going to track that down and get that corrected. This for the final record, not that I'm asked to change the book. It doesn't rise to any much magnitude. It's minor. But anyway, in 68, Georgia had gotten elected, and Georgia, as she was for 21 solid years.
Georgia Davis Power.
Yes. Every year we went to her with the legislation we needed, and nearly every session she got it passed. Mm-hmm. And so we went to her, and we got again not only the federal bill, but we did better than the federal bill, the Federal Fair Housing Bill. We were clearly first in the South on that, again, as we had been in 66. And it was good legislation, and it wasn't that much of an improvement over the federal legislation, but it was, we got their coverage, their exclusions, exemptions were a fourplex. In other words, if you were in an owner-occupied fourplex, you could get yourself exempt. You could discriminate in the other three units. We cut that to two. In other words, if you were an owner in a duplex, you could exclude people from, you were not covered for the other one of your two units. But if you had three or four, you were covered. And there were other important distinctions.
So how did you go about documenting housing discrimination? Did you wait for people to bring individual complaints to you?
Never.
Did you send out testers?
We did not at that stage do much testing at the State Commission on Human Rights. We advertised widely. We publicized the bill, and we encouraged people to file complaints. And we aggressively went after those. I would have to look here. This is the other thing that I had in my notes I want to be sure that we covered. I would have to look here to see what year it was. But we immediately discovered that we weren't getting very good recoveries in our housing cases. Okay? Mm-hmm. I'm sure I told you
recoveries
that WAG.
Meaning like damages?
Money.
Right.
Damages. Okay, I told you that WAG before about Oberst and another day, another $100. Okay, all right, to solve that problem. Because see, with the state of the law, we didn't have any, you can't put fines into these things because that becomes repugnant and you can't get the legislatures to adopt them. And so under the law, you can only get damages for out-of-pocket costs. Mm-hmm. So we weren't getting any recoveries. Mm-hmm. And the difference is important as compared with employment. In employment, you have lost wages. Mm-hmm. So if you can recover lost wages, you can get a piece of change.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but you didn't have that in housing. Mm-hmm. They just, if they had to go and pay $350 as compared to $325, you might be able, in the right circumstances, to get that difference. But not otherwise, okay? So whenever it was, I think roughly 72, to remedy that fact, whenever it was, it tells us in here, whatever year it was in the 70s, I'm almost certain. I could, there's no sense holding you up, and I just failed to look this up before. But clearly, we decided that we had to be able to get damages for embarrassment and humiliation. Mm-hmm. And this was not a well-developed concept in the law. Well, what actually happened was, out of our learning experience, we were finding that we needed an additional remedy. Okay, so we went back to Georgia, mm-hmm. and we got her to put in this amendment that said that they could recover damages for embarrassment and humiliation. Okay? Mm-hmm. We were riding along real well at getting damages for embarrassment and humiliation, but then we had this case that Judge Meigs decided out of Frankfurt.
Meigs?
M-E-I-G-S. Okay. He was kind of a bourbon. He was came from wealthy families and didn't fully appreciate these things. he and his wife Sally were very prominent socially, and that's all right. I'm not knocking that, but he decided this case involving the Clays against us, even after we got this statute, okay? And he said that you can't get damages for embarrassment and humiliation, even though the statute was there, you know. Mm-hmm. He essentially declared that unconstitutional. So we set out to prove the importance of damages for damages for embarrassment and humiliation.
Now, these were cases that were going into state or federal court?
No, nearly all of the things we did in state court. Well, we needed to build the law in Kentucky.
Right.
That's
right.
What we were into. And like I said before, part of this process was built on the development of the new level of the Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. We had all these new judges. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, we for the first time got three levels. You got the Circuit Court, you got the Court of Appeals, and you got the Supreme Court. We hadn't had a Supreme Court before. Mm-hmm. And so when the Court of Appeals got themselves elevated, and rightly so, to be the Supreme Court, then we had all these new judges that came along at the same time as the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, you look at some of these names. Well, I don't know why I'm looking for the names. Their names aren't going to be here. But in that other publication here, look at some of these names. And these were people who, in the nature of things, were, you know, they knew, they had a sense of history. I think that's what's so important in so many of these things we were working on. They had a sense of history, and it wasn't like they were just dumbbells out there floating in a boat in a river. You know, they knew that these things were important. Judge Stevenson, Ray Stevenson. Let's see. Let me find some of these other judges here. The guy out of Lexington, who was just a prince on every one of these things he could get hold of. He just took it and ran with it. Let me come back to that Middleborough housing case. But anyway, I wish I could come quicker with some of these judges.
While you're looking for those, Galen,
Judge Martin, mm-hmm. Out of the Court of Appeals. Judge Martin was in out of Lexington.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these other judges that it was just, you know, I think Will.
So they had a sense of history, and they were also empathetic to the issues.
Yeah,
being
that's right.
Before.
Yeah, and that's
okay.
Why.
Okay.
And so they, but we had lost. Judge Miggs had decided against us. Well, that case was coming on for appeal from the Franklin Circuit to the Court of Appeals. And so a lot of the reason we went to all this trouble was to build the background and the history for this type of damages. Mm-hmm. And the reason we held the first hearing in Covington was so we could get this extremely prominent psychiatrist out of Cincinnati to just simply come across the river, as distinguished from coming to Louisville or somewhere way down here, come across the river and testify. And he was the country's foremost expert on this matter of psychic damage. And he had worked a lot on this case out of West Virginia. I think it was called Buffalo Creek or something like that, where this dam, the sludge dam at the coal mines broke and killed all these people. Okay, and he was a expert witness for the people that were trying to recover from the coal mines, mm-hmm. Coal mine companies, in that action. And, you know, whatever his name is, it doesn't really matter that much, but he is a superb.
But you called him to testify about psychic damage to individuals denied housing?
Yes. No, not housing, but to psychic damage because of things like discrimination.
Okay.
In other words, it's the whole theory of compensatory damages and restitution. James Tischner, that was the guy. And see, we brought in national people. You know, Schwimm appears later on, but I don't know offhand. He was a UK prof and still is a UK prof. I don't know at that point whether he was still at Chicago which he came to UK from Chicago, but he was a preeminent housing discrimination lawyer.
Robert Schwem, S-C-H-W-E-M-N.
Yes, he is definitely a compatriot of Ober's.
Okay.
And see, all these other people, this guy's from Cleveland, Hickman was from Philadelphia and so on, and we brought people from all around the country at both these hearings, but Tischner was the lead guy. And then Laufman had done a lot of housing cases and so on. But you know what? All I'm saying is we had method to our madness.
Right.
I'm perfectly willing to be considered mad, but this was not, we were not just, you know, sloshing through the swamp. We knew what we were doing. And the amazing thing about this is that we developed this theory of the law for damages for embarrassment and humiliation because we saw the need in housing. But it's had an even more significant national impact in employment. Now, early on, we had a case, and it's one of the cases in here, I think, involving a restaurant in Richmond, Kentucky. It was named the Bonanza Steak Pit. I knew what was going to happen the minute we went to that hearing. I knew somebody was going to slip. Fortunately, it was their lawyer, and their own lawyer referred to it as the Bonanza Snake Pit. And what was involved there was that they discharged this woman because she was pregnant. Mm-hmm. Okay? And again, at her previous job, she had made more money than what she made at the snake pit. So she wouldn't have gotten any money. You know, in the analogy I set up earlier, she wouldn't have gotten anything if she couldn't get damages for embarrassment and humiliation. Well, we discovered that this thing we had erected so carefully only in a loose sense, you know, we erected it. It just had a lot more application in employment. And other people have taken this thing up nationally and built on it in employment cases. And of course, we'd built on it ourselves. While I'm rattling on here, I don't mean to take all your time.
Let me try and summarize a piece of that. You're saying that what was developed here in that respect was precedential for use in other parts
yes.
of the country?
Yes. Okay. Especially in employment, but also in housing, especially in housing. I'm not trying to tell you what to do or anything, but if you want background on this, you can call the woman who was really the prime editor of this. Mm-hmm. Her name is Sarah Pratt. Mm-hmm. And she, until very recently, she worked, you know, with us at the commission, and then she went on to work, I would say, 10 or 12 or what have you years. That's Sarah Pratt there, with HUD. Again, directing their enforcement program. She finally gave up in utter total desperation and quit here a few months ago. She works now for another private group.
Let me go back to the 1968 housing statute. Talk about that. Was that difficult to get through the legislature, or were people generally supportive of it? Who introduced it?
Powers. She introduced everything.
Okay.
Everything we did for her whole 21 years, she led the pack. Mm-hmm. And she introduced it, and she got it out of the Senate real quick, and then it, you know, get fuzzied around in the House, but we ultimately got it passed in the House. It's just, you know, these things, I can't tell you that they were hard. They just weren't that hard. We got a climate going. We got mainly out of what happened in the 60s. And there were so many leaders down there, not everybody. Some of those people didn't like us, and some of them were never like civil rights and so on, but the climate, the overall leadership, and most obviously the climate under Combs was the world's best and almost as good under Breathitt, or maybe in some ways better under Breathitt, but and then it sort of trickled down, I would say. Till it lessened, you know, it was not that bad under, I told you earlier, it was not that bad under Louis, but it kind of trickled down. I don't think it had much standing under Wilkerson or some of those, or John Wild Brown. He was never going to do anything, obviously, open bad about civil rights, but he was never going to be very good.
But 1968 was a pretty pivotal year with riots across the country.
Oh, absolutely, including Louisville.
And riots in
Louisville. Yeah, it's pictured in the...
And sort of the, you know, the whole black nationalist movement kind of coming more out front. And did those, the riots and black power, did that play a role in any way in terms of influencing legislators' values or...
I just don't know that a lot of things I remember real well. That's the guy in the speech I was telling you about that they attributed to Pritchard.
Well, just your sense of that whole black nationalistic movement. I mean, for example, did you have staff who became more out front in terms of black power? Was that an issue for you? Internally, the way it was, for example, in the CORE chapter, you know, where CORE, which had been a mixed racially group for a while, you know, long about 67, 68, a lot of those CORE chapters told the whites, thank you, we don't want your help anymore.
Well,
what about your staff and all of that?
I'm trying to, okay, Hughes McGill, see, Georgia had power, mm-hmm. not only in her name.
Right.
The commission had power in the statute. Mm-hmm. Clearly there were demonstrations, obviously, well, here's the whole timetable. Well, our outlets, of course, were more in those days in terms of getting these Fair Housing Acts adopted in other cities. That's what a lot of our effort went into, now that I'm reminded of it. And see, for instance, the funny thing was that we got the... George's bill added housing, but it also, for the state, but it also authorized local human rights agencies to adopt their own housing ordinances. Mm-hmm. And so that swept the state. One of these jurisdictions adopted it before they had the power. I think that may have been Bardstown in Nelson County, I'm pretty sure. We sent out a model ordinance. And they up and adopted it, even though it wasn't really due to go into effect until July. They adopted it prior to that. But clearly, then we got them adopted in Covington and Kenton and Fayette. The Louisville Board of Aldermen, after much machinations. No, wait a minute. I've got my card a little bit before the horse here. Yeah, I'm citing some stuff that happened in '67. It was in March of '68.
In '68.
Yeah.
Open housing. Okay. But your recollection is that it went through in a fairly orderly manner. There was not public opposition to it.
That's my recollection. Okay. Yeah, nearly everything was going our way in this period.
Okay. Do you remember the Louisville riots?
Yeah.
What can you tell
me? Well, the funniest thing that happened, one of the weird things was that Herb Seavers and I, he was our community services director and he was black. He and I were in a state car and we went out here to, I don't know what street it was, but maybe 28th and Dumesnil or somewhere out there. And we saw this...
Dumesnil, what was that?
D-U-M-E-S-N-I-L, Dumesnil.
Okay.
I think it's the way you pronounce it, I'm pretty sure. And we parked and got out of our car or something. But we talked with this one black guy who was out there on the street. I don't know, I think he just... or just around. I was not aware he was doing anything particularly. And then later on, we, Herb and I drove down to the city police department and walked by the jail to see who was being arrested. And bingo, here was this guy. He got himself arrested. But, you know, the thing was, it was just like in a lot of other cities. It was just out of hand, and people were breaking out windows and setting fires and so on. It was just a bad, bad time.
Is it, how did the police handle it here in Louisville?
Well, I think that they did not really get horribly out of hand. I think that they were doing more or less what you would expect them to do.
Okay.
I don't know, you know, of course in 67, I think we had the office down here in the building where we talked about May Street Kid being. I think, yeah, we had that office at that time. I'm pretty sure we had it in 67. But our main office was in Frankfort at that point. But we were up here, and you know, I don't want to imply that I was involved or what have you that directly. And basically, by and large, our employees were not that deeply meshed in the demonstrations. Mm-hmm. Some of them were, some weren't.
Can you recall the names of any who were involved in the demonstration?
Not really.
Okay. I want to ask you about two employees specifically, Ann Beard Grundy and Chester Grundy.
Yes.
Now they met here.
Yes.
And eventually married.
Yes.
And what do you remember about them when they were here as employees?
Well, the most striking thing, of course, is in the morning paper again, and that is that Ann was involved in the church where the young girls were
Birmingham
killed.
Church,
yeah, and of course she went to Berea College like I did.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, they were good people. Ann was, you know, she was, I think it's fair to say, was a disgruntled employee, not necessarily all the time, but at times. I remember one time she met me out on the street. We were not, you know, wasn't the street far removed from the office, and as I went by, she kind of muttered out, "Honky."
This was over in Frankfort, or no? Were you
no,
here
it was
in Louisville,
here in Louisville.
At that point?
Here in Louisville, which I don't think she ever worked with us in Frankfort. I think that she and Chester were up here. Mm-hmm. We were in the Mammoth Life Building at that point.
Okay.
We'd gotten a lot more money.
Was she still working with you? And she
yes,
called you home?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But you know, some things in life you just got to
right.
you got to know in your own person right. that you're doing what you have to do and just go on. And I don't. We right. never talked about it later or anything. Right. But
Ann and Chester both became very influenced by that whole black cultural arts movement that came out of black nationalism and. You know, getting back in touch with your roots in Africa, and I believe they helped to start a festival here. I don't remember the name of it and whatnot. And that goes back to what I was asking you earlier about when Black Power and all of the ramifications of that came in. Did you notice any of that in terms of staff relations, community relations here in Louisville? I wonder if Ann calling you Honky might have been, you know, a good
well,
example.
I'm not sure
of
what
that,
you mean, did I notice? In other words, we were a state agency, we were charged with enforcing a law.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, we did the very best we could to
sure.
get state employees who would enforce that law.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were not into paying people to do anything except enforce the law.
Right. And of course their interest in the black cultural arts came, I think, after they had left the agency. I mean, that was another activity for them
uh-huh.
on the outside. But
well, a lot of employees I've kept up with over the years after their departure, many, many hundreds,
mm-hmm.
but I just have not had that much contact. I have definitely followed
right.
their career, and I'm glad for all their accomplishments and
right.
glad that they found a niche at UK where they apparently fitted.
Right.
Chester.
Right.
Well, I don't know that Ann had any connection with the UK connection, but I have followed his work from afar. I've never had any occasion to talk with him that I can recall over these years, but the commission had a mission to enforce the law, and we had no particular mission to, it was not for us to pass on black power.
Right.
Georgia had power, and the other legislators had power. Oberst exercised power as he presided over the hearings. The courts had power. That's not the same as black power, but what, you know, I don't know what you're thinking that maybe we should have been doing to relate to black power, or...
Well, I'm not suggesting that you should have been doing anything. I'm just wondering if you observed sort of the ramifications of that any way in Louisville. Or
I couldn't for the life of me remember when this happened. But we sponsored these annual conferences for colleges, okay? And we held them at various places. You know, we obviously held them at the University of Kentucky. We held them, I think, maybe at Berea. I can't really remember. I've been to so many conferences, they all run together. And clearly that was one of the ramifications that I can remember. Okay. And we, you know, we must have done this, I don't know, five, six, what have you, years, and I can't remember if it was coming down when Ann and Chester were there. I cannot fix the period. Okay. I don't know when it was. But I would think into the 70s that more rather discussion turned to whether or not whites should be excluded. Okay. And so most of the people who were there voted to exclude whites. So I left. You know, I think that is a pile of crap. And here we are, this is the government. Government money that's paying for a government-sponsored conference. Okay? I am not for allowing any citizens to be excluded on the basis of their race from anything that is government-sponsored. So I think that was wrong. I remember particularly, you know, I was out at Camp Otter Creek, to Otter Creek Park. I remember, you know, fairly clearly coming back and getting my lunch at the Kingfish Restaurant out there on Dixie Highway. Well, what the heck?
And who was sponsoring this meeting?
The Kentucky Commission on Human Rights.
So it was
sponsoring
your
meeting.
It was your meeting.
Yeah.
And yet.
And I'm not implying anything as to, it wasn't like they put me out as the head of the staff as compared with other people who were white. I think the essence of the action was to put out all whites.
Did other whites leave with
you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't document this, and I don't have any idea as to what who was there or who wasn't there. But I think that one of our staff members was probably instrumental in that action, putting us out. Well, I think that's wrong.
I assume you had some conversation with the staff?
No, I don't recall having any conversation about with the staff about that. I don't remember that. I just, you know, whenever you can, you march on and go on to your next objective. And
well, that does sound like a pretty good example of what I was asking.
And you know, there was for some years the underlying notion of why do we have a white guy who heads this staff? You know, that's life. And of course, I don't know if you were asking me that the other day or not, but see, the key thing is, when I started in this field, everybody was ecstatic to get whites, and mostly preachers. We got entirely too many preachers who didn't have the, you know, they had good intentions and their heart, as the saying goes, was always in the right place, but I think they weren't enough steeped in social action necessarily. It doesn't come, it's not a part of the ministerial training. So So I think that's just the way things got started. Of course, the whole field has shifted now. I understand that, and I've not resisted that. Mm-hmm. I don't think I really resisted it individually, and I certainly don't resist it professionally. Mm-hmm. You go to the meetings of the, you know, I was head of both the national groups, both the National Association of Human Rights Workers. I've just been back from that meeting, mm-hmm. And the same thing is true in the other one. It's the so-called international, not really international, it's us in Canada, mm-hmm. International Association of Official Human Rights Agencies. Well, I headed both those over the years, mm-hmm. and they've changed dramatically. You know, they're overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly black, mm-hmm. and that's all right. You know, it's because the staffs are overwhelmingly black now. At the commission, we really did a wonderful job of having a balanced black and white staff. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, we had problems. I had complaints filed against me. The thing, it got all jerked around. But mm-hmm. but in the nature of working in this field, if you don't get some complaints filed against you and you've got a staff that's half black and half white, there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. And so again, none of those ever stuck. They were never proven, and so on, and I just, you know, that's stuff you had to live with, and there are those who think I should have gotten out sooner. Mm-hmm. Maybe I made a mistake to stay almost 29 years. I don't know, but I thought it was my life's work and that I was doing good work till the end. And mm-hmm. and a lot of these things that we were doing, they ain't getting done anymore.
Okay.
And that's all right too, but in terms of the statistical reports, the emphasis on school desegregation, and of course the there's a lot more representation of the separatists,
right,
on the board, appointed by the governor. We didn't have that. We had no separatists appointed that board. The other thing I want to mention to you, and I put in my notes here, I can't remember if I told you this or not, but clearly, we never employed anybody for political reasons. Did I say that before?
No.
Okay. We never mm-hmm. employed. Once in a while, I would get calls, you know, the way it works in Frankfurt. I'm sure you know that.
Well, I've heard this from other people.
Well, believe me, it's been a problem, and I think it's getting worse. That's, again, I'm not an expert on that.
And,
I don't know.
These
in terms of political appointees. No,
governors,
no. These were people around the governor's office.
Mm-hmm. Wanting you to hire their family or their
well, or someone for
or someone
for political purposes,
mm-hmm.
and I never argued with them. I just ignored them. And I'm mm-hmm. serious. Of the hundreds of people that we employed, we never employed the first one for mm-hmm. political purposes. Mm-hmm. And of course, well, part of the problem is I knew if we got, as they referred to these people as drones, you know, down there, if we started hiring drones, we weren't going to have anybody do the work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I just knew we had too much work right. cut out for us, and right. so I succeeded in doing it.
Right.
And we never discriminated on the basis of race. We were into constant efforts to recruit blacks, and it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about some of the early commission members. Philip Ardery, Arderey, was your chair in 1961. Do you remember that? Now he's the lawyer.
No. This is the advisory committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights.
Oh,
Phil is
okay.
a print again. He's a
okay.
very high type guy.
Okay.
It's not criticism or anything, but have you by any chance read the latest book on Pritchard?
I have.
Well, that's the Phil. That's
right.
Phil.
I know it is.
They're both yeah. very good men.
Right.
Very
well,
good men.
I misread that, and I thought
yeah.
he must have been. So he was. I see. This was not clear to me. I thought that these were people who were signing off on this report to the commission. But he was on the state advisory committee.
To the U.S. Commission on
okay.
Civil Rights.
And your agency, did you have anything to do with that committee?
Our ships hardly passed in the night.
Okay.
No, we fed things in. We would attend their meetings. We would present materials to them and so on. I shouldn't have said what
okay.
I said. Clearly, these were sister groups.
Uh-huh.
But this, see, that U.S. Commission was headed by Arthur Fleming.
Mm-hmm.
He's the long-term head of it.
Right.
Again, a dear friend. and a longtime supporter. And I knew the staff, a lot of the staff, people who heads that. Mm-hmm. Bill Taylor is one of the most illustrious people, and he's an advisor to us in the school desegregation mm-hmm. suit. These were, you know, they were cooperative groups. And I see Phil at Actors Theater from time to time, and he came when I had a meeting for my campaign. While Phil came to the first meeting to try to advise me as to how to run against Jim Bunning and mm-hmm. so on. Mm-hmm. He's a good man. As is his wife. I like them both very much.
I took this document actually out of the collection from your commission in the State Library. So somehow somebody has gotten them intertwined in the record collection there. But thank you for
that's very proper. Yeah. It's very proper that be there.
On that. Well, are there other areas that you really wanted to cover in particular?
Well, let me go ahead and give you one illustration here. Back to the Bonanza snake bit case. Again, the hearings were conducted by the lay members of the commission. Mrs. Weatherford, the wife of the president of Berea College, was a superb presiding officer for hearings. She presided over the hearing in the snake pit case. And she was, the daughter of a commander of a carrier or something, a Navy commander type. And she, I don't know that for a fact. I shouldn't cite that. But she was an outstanding member. And she had this finesse about her that she could bang that gavel, in which the lawyers never thought to ask, is that lady a lawyer, which she wasn't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And once we had a hearing down at Cumberland Falls, it was cold. The guy from Corbin, who was supposed to be there, tried to call and get the hearing postponed because of the weather. Mrs. Weatherford was there ready to conduct the hearing, and she had come through Corbin, so he didn't get very far. Now, admittedly, she had a four-wheel vehicle, but that was the kind of dedication that we had from her and Oberst and the other members of this commission.
How did you get to be a hearing officer?
Well, people just sort of volunteered. I mean, not everybody tried.
So the commission selected people for the
yeah.
position.
Mostly it was our lawyers. Nearly all the people who conducted hearings were lawyers, but Paul and David Welch and Schwimm and Jim Crumlin, who's black from here in Louisville, he conducted a lot of hearings, and a lot of others. I don't mean to name
was
all
that
the people,
but a volunteer task, or did they get financially remunerated in some way?
To the tune of $50 a day. $50. But it took us the longest time to get that set up. See, what we got established under one of the governors, probably after Breathitt, maybe under Breathitt, mm-hmm. but later on, I think, we got established that the commission members could get $50 a day. Big deal. Mm-hmm. If you're a lawyer,
right.
you get 50, you
right.
know.
Right. Plus but, the travel?
Yes, the travel was separate from that. That was in addition to their...
Okay.
So if you presided here, you got your $50. But the important thing is these people gave. And they were reliable, and they were first-rate people at conducting the hearings. And furthermore, what's so important about that case is that the case was before one of the worst judges for women, the circuit judge, who was Chenault, Robert Chenault, whatever Chenault was. He's since deceased. Mm-hmm. And he was the judge at Richmond. And he said in the hearing, when the case came on before him, he said, well, it was news to him that you couldn't fire a woman for getting pregnant. I mean, he was a Neanderthal. Mm-hmm. And of course, he decided the case. He overturned Mrs. Weatherford in her hearing. But again, these guys on the Court of Appeals, they took care of that.
Right.
And the involvement of these people, you know, this is not lost on a Judge Lambert. You know, who's now on the court, who's from London.
Now, you give me the date again that you started doing the hearings.
Well, the hearings kind of grew like Topsy. I don't know when the first was held, but it had to have started, you know, if we didn't get started in 66, we got started in 67.
Okay.
This thing is set out somewhat chronologically.
And did you have, how How many, were many hearings, rulings appealed?
In the early period, yes. We had as many as, you know, 12 or what have you on appeal at certain times. I mean, that is a god awful lot of cases for a little outfit like ours. And you know, we were holding at certain times, not all the way, but at certain times, we were holding better than an average of a hearing a month. I see that the first one of these is at Whispering Hills Country Club, where they got caught because they were excluding blacks from dances at the country club. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they excluded this one lieutenant. And he had some legal training, and he he filed a complaint. And that was in 72. So again, it wasn't, well, we undoubtedly held hearings, but there were none of them that got appealed or that we had to appeal.
Okay. When we talked the other day, you asked me to remind you to tell me about Governor Combs' accommodation order.
Yes. Okay. Now that was cited in the Pritchard book. Okay. Combs, he understood the law and he understood leadership, and I just think what he did was fabulous. It was a way in which the law should have been developed. It should have gotten developed, but he got shot down. He said that the state was licensing all of these public places of public accommodations, and therefore the state, as a part of their licensing requirement, could require them to serve all citizens of the Commonwealth. He issued an executive order to that effect. He was absolutely on solid ground. I cannot honestly claim to you that we went to him and urged him to do that. He did that on his own to some extent. Obviously he had to have consulted with Pritchard. He did not really consult with us, but he did it. And it should have survived, you know. It was as far as the law and what the law ought to be doing in this country, it was a magnificent stroke. But he got beat down politically because the election came along and Louis Nunn ran. Louis ran on the executive order. He ran as against that. It got into the campaign so quickly that we really couldn't ever get it implemented. Mm-hmm. But it's just another illustration of the kind of leadership that the country needed and that Kentucky provided. Admittedly, we got beat back on it, but I just think that it was, and Combs, he was marvelous. At our lawyers meeting for school case on Friday, this guy quoted, he quoted Combs in behalf of Kara. Mm-hmm. He said that Combs said, maybe you've heard this one, Combs was so good on these wags, I'd just love to hear another one, and I hadn't heard. He said that Combs said, we sued under Kara to get a thimble, and they gave us a bucket. And that's so true.
That's right, because he actually was the lawyer for the lawsuit that resulted in Kara.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's Combs. That's right. Combs to a T.
Galen, you have used the word the wag a number of times now. Tell me the origin of that word. What does that mean to you? Do you know, is it something an expression you grew up with?
I consider all those expressions like that, of which Combs were very good. You know, it's some of them were little puns. Mm-hmm. You know, Combs was deep into little puns.
Right. No, But
wag is just a turned phrase, I think. I don't know what it means.
Mm-hmm. A wag. Okay.
It's just his little way of saying things.
Right. But you also use it. You've used it.
Yeah.
As we've talked the last few days.
I don't doubt it. It has no.
Expression that you know.
I would think it is.
Or an idiom.
I don't know where I've heard it, or from Berea College or West Virginia or not. I don't know. Maybe it's not proper.
I'm sure
I'll go look
is.
In the dictionary when we get through.
Okay. Is there anything else that you want to add to our talk?
One other thing that we did that was of significance, at least,
was we held these seminars for black elected officials. And we, I think, unquestionably succeeded in increasing the numbers of black elected officials in our time. These were really very good conferences. One of the stars of them was, of course, Luska Twyman, who from Glasgow, who had been a principal, who had been a mayor, who had Louis Nunn tried to jerk him around in terms of local political stuff down there.
He was a Republican, as I recall, too.
Yeah, yeah. The this is not relevant to what I'm talking about, but the sad tragedy is that of the 72 districts that have no black teachers now, Glasgow's among them. So we've gone a long way down. But Luska came to those. We had the people out of Hopkinsville who came to those. It was primarily the black elected officials from Louisville were sort of above. I don't mean that in a put-down way, but I mean, you know, they wouldn't, they, I think deep down they were busier in some ways, and they were not as isolated as the other black elected officials from around the state were. But see, what we did was we, you know, everything that we did by way of statistical report, I know I said this before, had a specific action outlet, and we got the outlet from that. We, the reports that we did had a very emphatic result in terms of cities that noticed, and we called it to their attention, that they didn't have any black elected officials. And when a vacancy occurred, a lot of them would go looking for a black. And then they would appoint the black to the city council, and then the guy or gal would get reelected. And that happened a lot of times.
What period did you begin these conferences? Are we talking about the 60s, the 70s?
Well, again, it's just hard for me to remember when that
80s.
Was. I'm, you know, my guess is that we really got swinging on them in the 70s, okay. And that they carried well up into the 80s, but I can't say for certain.
Okay, that's okay, but that just places it a
but I know that they were, you know, they were influential. I mean, and we, you know, we we got up the overall numbers, clearly as a result of the reports, we got the numbers up. That reminds me of another area, okay, with reference to public housing, okay. Now we, you don't have to believe this, but when Kennedy became elected president, you know, he promised that he would end segregation in public housing with a stroke of a pen. He did. He said that. Dick Gregory spoke to the Human Rights Workers Conference a full year later, when they had the shore in Washington, and Dick said he didn't understand how a man who could read so fast could write so slow, because Kennedy had never signed the order. He did later on. And soon after this, he signed that order. We went to work on public housing desegregation. We really did. And at that time, I was still second in lists, showing the black projects. But and again, one of the beauties of everything that we did was we got such fabulous press because of the leadership of the Binghams and the followership of reporters all over the state. And one of the things that we did in those reports, and we did 12 to 15 annual reports on public housing segregation and desegregation. One of the things we did was we put out a list of the most segregated districts. Well, that got great press. That got the most press of anything we ever did. Okay, the reason was because we tailored that thing for every one of these newspapers, and we would point them to exactly where their city was cited on what page. Okay, and they went right for that, and so they got it. They came out with headlines that says Hopkinsville, fifth most segregated public housing in Kentucky, and we got that all around the state. And one of the funniest things that ever happened was we put out our report on the 10 worst. Well, naturally, an enterprising reporter, this guy happened to be in Danville, he got our figures down, and Danville was there, it's just we didn't raise them up to the level of the 10. He didn't hesitate a bit. He reported Danville, 15 most segregated public housing. And see, that was the kind of thing we had going for us. And it was just, you know, marvelous, the kind of impact that that had. And we, not only that, but one of the cases in here is the case against the Middlesbrough Housing Authority. See, we initiated, you kind of asked this question somewhat before, did we wait? No. We, in housing, we initiated roughly 5 or 6 complaints against public housing authorities that we found were segregated. We went after them. We see, our commissioners could they not only heard the cases, but they could, not in the same case, but they could also, in separate cases, initiate a complaint. They could sign that to the best of their knowledge and belief, such and such and such and such were the facts. Mm-hmm. Well, then somebody else worked on that case. Obviously, the staff people worked on it, but and some other commissioner would preside if that went to hearing. Well, we initiated those against Richmond and several others, Covington, I think. But anyway, Middlesboro was the one that we went after particularly. Mm-hmm. And that's the one that that is the number two of these cases, and that was in 77. Mm-hmm. And that case went again to the Court of Appeals. You know, we went through the local courts and the circuit courts down there and so on, obviously we held a hearing and so on. But anyway, in that case, our Circuit Court of Appeals folk, strike circuit, our Court of Appeals folk, they hadn't heard all the semantic stuff out of the court cases were around Washington. You know, the semantics that arose between the people who were always very careful to say doles instead of quotas. Mm-hmm. You know, quotas was bad, goals were good. Right. Okay. They hadn't read that. So they said that the commission could order a quota. And we got this situation through that case and the others that we had initiated. We got 18 public housing authorities in this state to sign affirmative action desegregation agreements with our commission. Okay, and then you know what that takes to go from Kennedy's stuff to get 18 of those. It's painstaking. And then the U.S. Justice Department, this was under Carter, the Attorney General Assistant Civil Rights guy was named Drew Days. He's been later been the solicitor.
D-A-Y-S?
D-A-Y-E-S.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. He initiated a case which they didn't even ask us about. They kept reading these reports and we kept telling them how Owensboro was getting worse and worse. They just up and filed a U.S. federal court suit against Owensboro. And that was at the time when Gordon and Hogan and I went to lunch one day over here, and Gordon said, and about that suit down there at Owensboro, just elected a new mayor. Of course, the guy was a political guy named J.R. Miller, since been up to his ears in politics. Well, he's always been up to his ears in politics. But anyway, Gordon said, we just got a new mayor, and I think he's going to get a new attorney for the city, and they're going to settle that suit. So that's what they did. But then under Reagan, they brought in Ed Meese, who's a crook, and Brad Reynolds, who was an idiot. Well, both of them were ideologues. And then they wrote a letter and destroyed all those agreements. So, and of course, they claimed we were overreaching and that they had no termination point and so on, but they trashed us. But that didn't detract from what we did. We knew what we were doing, and we went after it.
You've been involved in the organization, I guess, that is representative of your counterparts, the other commissions across the states. How would you compare the Kentucky Commission with the work done by other commissions around the country?
Well, I guess that earlier. I can't quote anything better than what Gary Overfield said.
Not
that in terms of education? No, not at all. Well, I gave two sentences. Okay. The first was that he heard from people, and most people believe that the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights was the best or one of the best in the country.
Gary said that no other commission, and that might be a factor in his mind. See, it may weigh more heavily in his mind, but he said no other commission had ever got within 10 miles of a school desegregation case. But I think, you know, unquestionably in our time, I think we did one of the better jobs. Mm-hmm. We put out more publications, we were more proactive, mm-hmm. we took the initiative in leadership, we definitely got the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, mm-hmm. and hardly anybody ever got that. Mm-hmm. For whatever, well, they didn't have Breathitt and his determination. But all across the board in the big issues, mm-hmm. in the big issues of school desegregation, which is still, no matter what other people may say, some people think that's beside us and it's off there somewhere or other, and I don't agree with that. Mm-hmm. The history of this country shows that that's the most important issue, just as race is the most important issue. And people may be off chasing other issues, but what we need, of course, is maintenance of effort with regard to race, because we have never, never solved the race problem. We just marched on to all these other things, and a lot of people forget about it, but that's the big issue. I think in each of these areas that I've highlighted, desegregation of schools and teachers and housing and publications, Black Heritage, Black elected officials, you know, all across the board, I think we've got leadership. And they were not proactive, mm-hmm. the way we were. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to stop there.